Hello again. Welcome to our To The Point podcast. I'm Warren Alney. Did COP27 make any progress in the fight against climate change? David Wallace Wells tells us the meeting of world leaders wasn't as bad as it looked. And he says the future of global warming isn't as bad as he thought it was just a few years ago. We'll hear from him, but first, the historic protest of a new generation of women against Iran's Islamic Revolution. If you weren't paying attention, it cropped up at this year's World Cup when Iran attacked the U.S. for a symbolic gesture on behalf of Iranian women's rights. Robin Wright, who reports for The New Yorker about her frequent trips to Iran, tells us how things are changing in Iran itself and in diplomatic relations. So, Robin Wright, thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to be with you, Warren.
This is a far cry from the last time that the United States and Iran met in the World Cup.
It is indeed. In 1998, both President Clinton in the United States and President Khatami in Iran had been working for basically almost a year to try to better connections between the two, largely through person-to-person or track-to diplomacy. And President Clinton even said at the time that both nations had been working to encourage exchanges and to help people develop a better understanding of each other's rich civilizations. Today, you see, in some ways, unprecedented tensions between the two nations, probably not as bad since the early days of the revolution in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
What all this is about, of course, is a challenge to the revolutionary regime by women. Tell us how that began and how it's working out right now.
The protest began on September 16th after the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Kurdish woman who was visiting Tehran, and the morality police objected to her headscarf. Apparently, her hair wasn't covered sufficiently, and she was hauled away to a detention center. What we don't know is what happened in the vehicle, because once she got to the detention center, she collapsed. And there is video of that, which has gone viral on social media. And she was taken to a hospital where she fell into a coma and died 3 days later. And this led to protests, spontaneous eruption, particularly in Kurdish area that quickly spread to Tehran and other cities, about issues not over just the hijab or the head cover for girls and women, but also over the issue of personal freedom and women's rights. And this is interesting that for the first time in human history, you are beginning to see a counter-revolution that was ignited by women, led by women, in which women are the primary force. It's been remarkable. And whatever its fate, these protests will go down in history for the role of women.
Elaborate, if you will, on the repression of women's rights in Iran, which I take it is quite severe compared to other places around the world. To what extent there has been an agitation about this over the years?
Well, in many ways, Iranian women are better off than women in Saudi Arabia. At least women in Iran have the vote. They are members of parliament. There's a female vice president. There has been under earlier presidents as well. The interesting thing and the dynamic that fostered these protests is really the fact that women are better educated. And it's very striking. During the monarchy, many traditional families didn't send their girls to school beyond the sixth grade because they were afraid that their girls would be exposed to miniskirts and makeup and Western mores. But after the revolution, traditional families sent their girls not only into higher education, but through universities. And 60% of the university student body in Iran today is female. And that has rippled through society, women aware of their place, their rights. And so you see Gen Z girls born between 1997 and 2012 who are well-educated. They want a place in society. They didn't suffer the hardships of earlier generations during the revolution, the post-revolutionary trauma, the war with Iraq, the efforts to kind of reconstruct. And so they don't accept the social contract anymore of protection by the regime or welfare by the regime as sufficient. They want rights. And so what you've seen is a real transformation that has been shaped by education and demographics. And, you know, women in Iran have always been allowed to drive. So when you talk about the rights of women, it's very different than some of the Gulf countries.
So they're not then, I'm incorrect in saying that women have been more severely repressed in Iran than in other places.
Well, they do have to cover themselves in terms of modesty. But one of the things that's been striking me, and I go to Iran, you know, quite often, is that the girls have been pushing the limits of hijab or headscarf for decades. I've gone to commemorations at the anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. embassy, which was very traumatic for Americans and is still commemorated in Iran, and I've watched the girls who once had to be covered in chadors and even their ankles covered, and now wearing jeans, very short covers over their legs, their headscarves precariously perched on the backs of their head. And I've marveled at how they do it, you know, black nail polish, makeup, and so forth. So you've seen the push for this for a long time, women testing the limits. And it took a trigger, a flashpoint, and that was the death of Mahsa Amini. That was something that ignited the imagination of Iranian women who've been pushing the limits for a long time. And now to do even more in challenging the regime, challenging the leadership, and shouting things like death to the dictator.
How are the men responding to this?
Well, it's striking that from their early days, a lot of the Gen Z men, young men, joined the protests. What we are all waiting to see is if the older generations join in these protests as well, which have been led largely by the young. The regime at one point announced that the average age of the people being arrested was 17. And so this really is a younger generation challenging the older one, the next two generations. And we haven't seen the kind of turnout by the older generations yet that might determine the fate of the regime.
Well, have we seen the police that you described taking more and more extreme measures against these young protesters?
Absolutely. And the regime has traditionally cracked down hard on protests. They did during more than 6 months of protests in 2009, when millions took to the streets across Iran to demand new elections because of allegations of fraud in a presidential election, or in 2017 over the price of poultry, or in 2019 over sudden gas price hikes. So the regime dispatches riot police, besiege these paramilitary wing of the Revolutionary Guards. It's engaged in draconian mass trials, the arrest of thousands. The international human rights groups claim there have been at least 15,000 arrested, more than 300 killed. And we know of at least six cases where young people have been charged with penalties that carry the death penalty. And these are all sending messages to the young protesters that the government intends to clamp down. So the question, of course, is what's the longevity of these protests? How persistent will they be? And how much further might the government go in trying to stop them?
What have we heard from the Ayatollah? To what extent is there any indication that he or the regime itself might try to resolve things in a more peaceful way?
The supreme leader has repeatedly insisted that the protests have been instigated, fomented, and supported by Iran's enemies, including the United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia. There's a sense that the government is so isolated, so disconnected from the population, that they don't realize the depth of antipathy toward the government. Remember, last year, Iran held presidential elections, and for the first time, the majority did not turn out to vote. Only 49% of the population elected a hardline leader. And I think the government has tried to lay the blame elsewhere and doesn't understand that the Gen Z generation no longer is willing to tolerate. And one important thing to know about the protests is that they cross ethnic and kind of tribal and all the different aspects, geographic divisions of Iran, that young generation may not have a vision of what the alternative is, but they certainly don't like the system in the Islamic Republic.
I asked earlier about the position of men, and you said that is yet to be seen, but apparently young men, certainly as indicated by the Iranian soccer team, are very much on the side of the protesters.
Well, the Iranian national soccer team decided not to sing the national anthem during their first meeting with Wales, but they did sing the national anthem on their second game. And so one of the questions is, has the government come down hard and said, sing or else? It's interesting, in 1998, during halftime, the Iranian officials came into the locker room and said, we're taking away your passports, and you won't get them back if you don't beat the United States.
Whoa. And that had to do with winning the game.
That's how important this game is. Soccer is incredibly popular in Iran, and sports in general. They're big on basketball, big on wrestling, and they like to compete against the United States as a way of showing that Iran is more powerful and can beat the United States. It's a symbolic thing, as well as a sports thing for the Iranians.
You talked earlier about the conditions that have existed in Iran and how women have been educated in so differently than they have in other countries. What about social media? How important has it been?
Well, social media has been incredibly important, and it was again in 2009. Iran was the first place that they used social media to broadcast the protests and inspired many others in the Arab Spring in 2011. So the government, one of its tools has been to cut off access to the internet so that people have limits on how they can broadcast videos of the protests. And we've depended on those because to find out what's happening inside Iran, because so few outside the country have had access. So they have used social media as they can. Instagram is arguably the most popular. Telegram is popular as well as a way of broadcasting what's going on and how far the Iranian kids are willing to go.
Given the isolation of the regime that you just talked about earlier, are there any figures of leadership who might actually challenge the supreme leader?
Not so far. One of the interesting things has been that the former reform leaders, President Rouhani, who was in power until August last year, President Khatami earlier this century, have been silenced throughout. And of course, one of the questions is, has the government silenced them? President Khatami had been banned from foreign travel, from being quoted in the Iranian media, and this predates the protests. One of the most dangerous positions in Iran is to be a former president because the government tries to isolate them once they leave office and quiet their voices. So in 2009, we saw the losing presidential candidates provide a kind of leadership. Former Prime Minister Mousavi and former Speaker of Parliament Karoubi. But they were put under house arrest, and a decade later, they are still under house arrest. So it's a dangerous thing to do is to get out in public and support protest movements. So it's been striking that no former leaders in Iran and some of the kind of familiar voices on reform efforts or in challenging the government have been silenced as well.
Well, it sounds like this is the most significant challenge to the regime since the revolution. What are the chances that there will be a lot more bloodshed before there's any kind of change?
I fear there will be a lot more bloodshed, but the idea of bringing about change is one that is you know, there, a lot of people wish that there would be either a change in the regime's behavior or a change in government. But the 2009 protests went on for more than 6 months and did not manage to bring about change. And this will take a cross-generational, cross-geographic involvement by many more people to actually bring about change. The one problem is that the young generation knows what it's against, but it doesn't have a leadership, an organization, or an idea about what replaces the regime, which is very deeply entrenched. So the idea that we'll see change tomorrow, I think, is illusory. The one big question is the health of the supreme leader. He's now 83, and a European diplomat told me several weeks ago that he again has cancer. He suffered from prostate cancer in 2014, and apparently some kind of cancer has recurred, diplomats say. So the question is, do these protests intersect with the looming transition of a man who's been the ultimate power now since 1989, 3 decades?
Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to date. It's extraordinary to find somebody with such access to a place that is so mysterious to most of us. Robin Wright, many thanks as always. Great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you, Warren.
COP27, this year's meeting of international leaders, has been widely panned for its failure to make measurable progress against climate change. But David Wallace Wells says it's still possible to be hopeful. Back with him in a moment on To The Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to The Point. The Uninhabitable Earth, that's the title of a long article in New York Magazine that became a book 5 years ago. The author, science journalist David Wallace Wells. Uninhabitable Earth lived up to its title. Climate change, Wallace Wells wrote, will be a catastrophic event, even if we take global action to stop it. But just 2 months ago, in the New York Times, he said he'd changed his mind. Sort of. The worst-case scenarios are less likely now than they appeared before, he says. Actions the world has taken have made a difference. But that's hardly the end of the story. After all, we're talking climate change, a threat to the human species, and Wallace Wells still calls himself an alarmist. So what's his assessment of COP27? That's the climate change conference of almost 200 countries that wrapped up recently after 2 weeks plus overtime in Egypt. David Wallace Wells, great to have you back on our podcast.
Good to be here. Great to talk to you.
Greta Thunberg predicted, as she did last year for COP26, that there would just be more blah, blah, blah. Are you more or less an alarmist after COP27?
Well, I think the story of this conference has been interesting in two ways. The first is that very little progress was made in terms of reducing carbon emissions or promises to reduce carbon emissions, which are obviously the things that drive future warming. In that sense, it's a disappointment, although I should note, as a conference, it was not designed to produce much more ambitious pledges. Some of these conferences do that. Some of them are focused on other things. And so it wasn't like this conference failed, but it did not deliver meaningful progress in terms of promises of future emissions reductions. But what it did deliver was the establishment of a new financing facility to support what are called loss and damage payments to climate-vulnerable countries. So climate change was a global problem, but it's distributed unequally. countries in the world that are around the equator primarily, and in general, the poorer countries of the world who've done least to produce the problem are facing the harshest consequences. And as a result, for a couple of decades, they've advocated in forums like these for the principle that the rich countries of the world who benefited from industrialization and produced an enormous amount of carbon along the way should be paying them to help them manage, navigate, and survive the climate impacts that were made inevitable by the development and prosperity of the global north. For the first time in this climate conference, the rich nations of the world have agreed to that. And I do think that that is a quite significant step forward because given the changing shape of expectations for warming this century, as you mentioned in your intro, it now seems likely that some of the worst case scenarios are much less likely and we're heading for some still scary but not apocalyptic futures. What that means is that the question of distribution, who will be impacted most and how will they manage, sort of becomes more paramount. And I think that this resolution at this COP, COP 27 in Egypt, represents the first real global step forward on that front. It's not quite a turning of the page away from decarbonization towards climate justice, but for the first time you're seeing issues of climate justice addressed directly and prominently by the world's most powerful and richest countries. And I think that that sort of initiates a new chapter of climate geopolitics.
And it was a difficult thing to achieve, required overtime at the conference in order to do it. Critics are still saying that, wait a minute, we haven't decided who's going to pay or how much they're going to pay or who they're going to pay it to. All that needs to be developed. And the U.S. is very concerned about whether China will agree to, in fact, be a donor under these circumstances.
Yeah, I think there are an enormous number of open questions here. We're at just the very, very beginning of this negotiation and project. It's like we are on loss and damage where we were in 1992 on climate. So we have a long way to go. And all of the questions that you raised are the open and important ones. But I do still think it's significant, as it was significant in 1992 when the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was ratified, that we have at least the in-principle commitment of countries like the U.S., who in the past have been quite resistant to this project, we have at least their commitment to try. It's not sufficient, as nothing on climate is, but it represents a step forward that I think is worth pointing out and to some degree celebrating.
You said this particular Congress of the Parties, which is what COP stands for, wasn't designed necessarily to reduce emissions. And yet there are those who are saying that it's backed away in some respects from agreements that were made last year in Glasgow at COP26. How concerned are you about that?
I think it represents a step backward. It's not exactly clear to what extent you can count this as a true step back from those promises, so much as a failure to push them forward. We're seeing probably fewer mentions in the final text of the 1.5 degree goal that was sort of introduced in the Paris Agreement and has become a rallying cry for the world's climate activists and the world's climate vulnerable countries since. And we saw a fight that was lost by more aggressive climate advocates to emphasize the need to not just phase down but phase out fossil fuels. Both of those are rhetorical fights which, you know, little to no progress was made in this agreement compared to last year and in years past. And in climate generally, when we're talking about, you know, a stalemate in which we haven't made progress over previous years, that represents a real lost opportunity given how little time we have to avoid climate catastrophe. On the other hand, given where we were last fall in Glasgow, you know, we're still there. I think we're not in a worse position. We just failed to take the opportunity to make progress. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, this conference was not designed to elevate those ambitions. It was called the Implementation COP. It was meant to enable not new promises of higher decarbonization ambition, but new agreements and negotiations and frameworks that would allow us to fulfill the promises, us being all the countries of the world, not just the U.S., allow us to fulfill the promises that have been made in the past. And there, I think we haven't made sufficient progress, again, as is always the case with climate, but there's more progress than initially meets the eye.
Well, what about the 1.5 goal? That's something that you've referred to in your more recent writing, as opposed to 2 degrees, which would be catastrophic and apocalyptic. How important is 1.5? What does that mean? Could you explain that to our listeners who've been focused on the politics in the last couple of weeks.
To begin with, the planet is now about 1.2 or 1.3 degrees warmer than the pre-industrial average. So we've raised the planet's temperature by what sounds like not very much, 1.2, 1.3 degrees, but it actually already puts us entirely outside the window of climate temperatures that includes all of human history. So we are already today warmer than we have ever been in the history of human civilization. And as a result, many of the things that were built in that climate and on it, an assumption of its continuity, are coming into question. That's, you know, we're seeing increased risks of agricultural failures. We're seeing infrastructure suffering under new climate conditions. We're seeing more intense droughts and heat waves and wildfires, all the things that your listeners are familiar with. That's just at 1.2 or 1.3 degrees. In Paris in 2015, in response to advocacy from, you know, climate protesters and the most vulnerable countries in the world, who believed that the standard that had been set in previous conferences of limiting warming to 2 degrees was insufficient, the world's governments agreed to try to limit warming at a lower level, 1.5 degrees. You know, the official text of the Paris Agreement says that we're committed to limiting warming to, quote, well below 2 degrees, and we're going to do everything we can to keep it as close to 1.5 as possible. Now, those two benchmarks have formed some of the standards by which we've judged climate action in the intervening 7-8 years. When we learned about the need to cut emissions in half by 2030 to hit our emissions goals, that was what we needed to do to give ourselves a decent chance of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. When we talk about getting to net zero in 2050, it's the same. Those are the benchmarks that are established by a goal of 1.5 degrees of warming. We also, in the interim, had a report, the 1.5 degree report of 2018 from the UN IPCC, that laid out the difference between what a world warmed by 1.5 degrees would look like compared to a world at 2 degrees. And it was quite stark, which gave further momentum and urgency to this project of limiting warming close to 1.5 degrees. Some of the impacts, you know, we'd expect 150 million additional people dying of air pollution just between those two thresholds, 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, from the burning of fossil fuels. We'd expect floods that used to hit once a century in many parts of the world would now be hitting every single year. We'd expect that in large parts of South Asia and the Middle East and really all across the equatorial band of the planet during summer, it would be so hot that you couldn't really work outside. And in some cases, you couldn't really safely go outside for long stretches without risking heat stroke and maybe even heat death. This is the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And as a result, the world was quite focused at a rhetorical level of trying to achieve 1.5. But we are really off track to get to that point. You know, we're going to reach a new emissions peak this year. We're probably going to reach a new emissions peak next year, which means all of our dreams of cutting our emissions in half by the end of this decade seem, let's say, quite ambitious. Personally, I think that they're totally out of reach. That doesn't mean that 1.6 or 1.7 or 1.8 degrees is out of the realm of possibility, but 2 degrees is, you know, is looking more plausible than 1.5 degrees as a sort of best estimate for where we're heading this century. And while that sounds awful, given all the scientific impacts that I've just described, and it is, it will be disruptive, it will produce an enormous amount of human suffering, and will raise many questions about the capacity of the world's geopolitics to accommodate that suffering and the migration that will likely inspire. 2 degrees of warming is also a lot better than where we thought we were headed just 5 years ago, when the same UN bodies projected what was called a business as usual scenario of 4 or 5 degrees. So, you know, we've missed out on our opportunity to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. I think, practically speaking, we can say that that goal is sort of over with, unfortunately. But we've moved significantly faster than was anticipated just 5 years ago, such that those really, really scary outcomes of 4 and 5 degrees of warming, and potentially even north of there, look much, much, much less likely than they did just a few years ago. And we can probably somewhat safely count on warming between 2 and 3 degrees, even if we do very little more than we're doing right now. We can still do more. We can limit warming. Say, you know, the UN says we're on track for 2.6 or 2.7 now. We can get it to 2. We can even get it below 2. So there's a lot of human agency as well. But I also think, despite all of the bad news we see every day about all of the unprecedented climate impacts all around the world, it's also worth remembering that, you know, given where all the action that's been inspired over the last 5 years, and the movement we've undertaken with decarbonization in the interim, we're now expecting, you know, a less apocalyptic future than we were expecting a few years ago. And that represents progress, even if it doesn't allow us to avoid climate disruption, disarray, and suffering.
Just should have mentioned that the degrees we're talking about are degrees centigrade, not Fahrenheit, which would be higher. You mentioned that we're hitting a new emissions peak this year, and we'll probably hit another one next year. So even as we begin to talk about this, even as we have COPs annually, we are still emitting more now than ever before.
Which means that we're doing more damage this year at sort of peak climate consciousness than we've ever done in all of, at any point previous in human history. And that's remarkable on many different levels, including, you know, a fact that I often mention that, you know, we've done half of all the damage that we've ever managed in all of human history just in the last 25 years. So while we think of this as a centuries-long problem that began in the Industrial Revolution in England in the 19th century or maybe 18th century, the truth is the vast bulk of the damage that's been done has been done in recent decades with the full knowledge of the scientific and political community, which is one reason to be somewhat skeptical, as I've been in the past, about how much knowledge and public awareness really can change our climate policy. But we have seen, in ways that I didn't anticipate just a few years ago, that some thresholds have been reached of awareness. Some tipping points have been initiated, and we're not moving nearly fast enough to avoid dangerous climate change. As I said earlier, that's sort of out of reach now. We are still moving fast enough, nevertheless, that some of the things that we were really scared of a few years ago now seem much less likely. And, you know, it's not a neat story. It's not climate victory. It's not climate triumph. But thankfully, it's also doesn't seem likely to be a story of true climate apocalypse either, of the sort that, you know, would bring about the possible civilizational collapse or the extinction of the human species, which is not something I thought was possible at 4 or 5 degrees, but others, you know, others often talked about it as though it was. Those futures are looking, you know, much less likely. And the future that we're kind of staring at seems to be defined by climate change, transformed by climate change, full of obstacles imposed on us by this warming, but not that are so large that we can't engineer some human future upon that landscape, which is, I hope, what we managed to do.
Doing that engineering, though, turns out to be political as much as it is scientific. I read somewhere that at COP27, there were so many people there from the fossil fuel industry lobbying the heads of state and the delegations, they would amount to the biggest delegation of all. What about that? And what about the iron hand of capitalism, as it always referred to, that grasps for more regardless of what the cost is to the planet?
Well, I think there's actually good news here, which is to say that from a true free market perspective, renewables are already the winner. In 90% of the world's population now lives in places where new renewable capacity is cheaper than dirty energy. The IEA, the International Energy Agency, has called solar power the cheapest electricity in history. And the price declines not just of solar power, but of offshore wind and onshore wind and of the battery technology that's necessary to make that power reliable at large scale. All of those prices have fallen dramatically over the last decade between, depending on which technology you're talking about, between by 60% and 90%. And those cost collapses are expected to continue, if not necessarily as dramatically in the next decade or two, then certainly they're going to keep falling, whereas the price of fossil fuels has stayed at least stable and has had, as we've seen with the Russia invasion of Ukraine, an enormous amount of additional volatility built in, which is all to say that anyone making any medium-term plans now is not thinking about a green transition as a burdensome transition that would be more expensive. And the iron hand of capitalism, as you called it, does not dictate that we stick closer to fossil fuels despite the impacts on the planet. That those laws of capitalism, if they were actually enacted honestly, would mean a much faster renewable transition than the one that we're progressing through right now. It would mean that anyone making any investments would be all in on renewables and nobody would be building out any additional fossil fuel capacity whatsoever. Now, that's not where we are, but that's not because fossil fuels are the choice of capitalism and renewables the choice of the Greens. It is because the fossil fuel business has captured much of the political economy of the world and slowed climate action now for decades. They're slowing it still today. And that means that we are still paying globally hundreds of billions of dollars every year in fossil fuel subsidies. Depending on if you want to count the environmental externalities you mentioned, you can tabulate those subsidies in the trillions annually. And that means that this is not actually a fair fight yet, which is all to say that actually the lowest hanging fruit for climate advocacy, climate advocates, is that we remove those fossil fuel subsidies and actually let renewables compete in the open market, because if they did, they would be winning running away. There are huge amounts of public policy questions about exactly how to build out those grids, how to design, an ideal energy mix. I don't mean to say that all we need to do is, let the free market work and the problem will be solved. But on the narrow question of whether our future should be based on dirty energy, which is also, by the way, killing 10 million people a year through air pollution, or clean energy, which is not just cheaper, but also safer and healthier for everyone, particularly those living around the source of that energy. On that narrow question, we don't need to appeal to environmental considerations or even public health considerations. We can just look at the economic calculus and say we would be better off growing cleaner rather than growing in a dirty direction. And I think that represents a real generational shift in how the future looks. And there's one reason why, as I wrote in that recent Times Magazine piece, while we're not at all out of the woods and climate change will be, in many ways disastrous, it's also the case that we're moving much faster than most analysts projected a few years ago, which means that, we're no longer heading for what used to look like an apocalyptic future, only one in which climate has disrupted but not brought to an end all of the promises that we used to take for granted.
When you talk about the economics of nations around the world, of course, that's a multitude of challenges. Let's take a quick look at what's happening here in the United States. We now have a GOP majority in the Congress, Republican majority in the Congress, where spending bills originate. Even when the Democrats were in control, President Biden wasn't able to get everything he wanted, although he did get one big goal, which is $370 billion to be spent to some extent on climate. What's the likelihood that there'll be anything more in the next couple of years coming out of the United States?
Well, I think that we probably won't have a major new piece of climate legislation in the next few years coming out of the U.S. Congress. But a few things about what's happened over the last year or two that I think is worth keeping in mind. You're absolutely right to say that Joe Biden ended up with a much smaller climate package than he had originally hoped for. It's much smaller than climate advocates had been pushing for and much smaller than comparable investments that are being made in some other parts of the world. But the price tag of that IRA bill, the climate bill that's called the Inflation Reduction Act, it's often quoted as $369 billion, but in fact, the outlay may be much, much larger since much of that spending comes in the form of tax credits. It really depends on how the market responds, and most analysts suggest that the market's going to respond much more aggressively than the Congressional Budget Office has projected, which means that we may actually end up spending much more than $369 billion just on those tax credits. It also helps establish some loan programs coming out of the DOE, which have essentially no limit, which is to say that there could be much, much more aggressive startup lending towards renewable energy than we've ever seen in the U.S. before, and that could really transform the energy landscape going forward. Beyond that, while the IRA got no Republican votes and had to pass by the skin of its teeth, on the whims of Joe Manchin's support, the truth is the two significant previous bills passed in the previous year, the Infrastructure Bill and the CHIPS Act, both contained significant climate provisions in terms of, both the need to compete with China for the in a sort of green energy marketplace, the green energy industrial marketplace, and in the kinds of spending that we're doing on things like school buses and train systems. And those, while the total dollar figures were a little bit smaller than the IRA, they were not at all insignificant. And they got quite a number of Republican votes because they were not understood to be narrow climate bills, but economic competitive bills that had some climate payoffs. I suspect that over the next few years, even if Republicans are still unwilling to vote for things that are headlined with climate goals in mind, like the IRA was, that they will be willing to vote for other bills that make investments in clean sectors. And when I look at the U.S., I'm still dispirited by how much climate skepticism there is on the right. On the other hand, I would point out two things. One is that there's much, much less true climate denial than there was just a few years ago. Basically, no elected official or very, very few elected officials are actually in denial of climate change. They just don't want to do anything about it. And while that doesn't sound like meaningful progress, it does represent some amount of progress. And secondly, when you look at the economic benefits of green energy and clean energy across the U.S., they're actually located disproportionately in red states. You know, Texas is the country's biggest provider of clean energy. And if you really roll that forward 5 or 10 years, I just have a hard time imagining the same kind of culture war resistance to climate initiatives, even in red states, that we're seeing today, because the economic benefits of continued public support for those projects in those places will be so large. Now, that's not to say, you know, right-wing resistance to climate policy will totally disappear. I suspect there will be some residual resistance, but I think that the sort of pure red-blue stalemate that we've become accustomed to thinking about when we think about climate policy is going to get a bit messier, which is to say there'll be more opportunities for smaller scale initiatives, even in the medium term.
What about the potential for loss and damage, as we talked about earlier in the program, here in the United States? Are we going to see more and more of that? Will that make people more aware of exactly what's going on?
Well, I think we already are. I mean, if we look at the way that hurricanes have affected the insurance market in Florida, for instance, or along the Gulf Coast of Texas, or the way that wildfire seasons have changed the way that fire insurance is structured in California, there are now many places where it's not clear that a private insurance market will endure, which means that more and more of that responsibility will be shouldered by the federal government and state governments, and many homeowners are going to be asked to pay significantly more of their own of the own premium there, which is going to change housing markets. It's going to change local politics, and I think it may change federal climate politics as well. I don't think that we're going to see a mass exodus out of, you know, the coastal areas of Florida. I think that people like that life just too much. But exactly what goes into making those homes relatively safe and insuring them after storms and making sure that the people whose homes and lives were damaged and destroyed by those storms are compensated in some way, I think is going to become a bigger part of our national politics as climate change becomes a bigger part of our national politics. And it is a reminder that however we think about the hierarchies of climate justice and injustice around the world, and it's important to keep in mind things like, you know, Pakistan had these incredible monsoon floods this year, which displaced 30 million people, despite the fact that Pakistan produces in its entire historical, you know, industrialization, the entire history of the country has produced only as much carbon as the U.S. produces every single year. Nevertheless, we're seeing many of those same patterns of, both inequality and increasing risk in the rich countries of the world. You know, it's not like Fort Myers, Florida was a place that was totally ignorant to climate risk a year ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And nevertheless, we are sort of building into that vulnerability, expanding our, expanding our development in places that are really quite dangerous in terms of climate change. And as a result, we're going to be reckoning with the impacts of warming much more than if we had taken a more climate responsible path of development a few decades ago. Exactly how that shakes out, I don't know, but it doesn't seem all that likely that we make a U-turn and start retreating from these climate vulnerabilities. It seems much more likely to me that we find creative ways of protecting those people who choose to live in the eye of the storm, so to speak.
In the meantime, of course, as you said, we're not doing enough and things are getting worse. How optimistic is it possible to be?
Well, you know, we talked about those different degree levels earlier, and they sound a little abstract, and probably to your listeners, they, you know, hard to sort of keep them straight. But the truth is, we are already outside the range of temperatures that enclose all of human history, which another way of saying that is we have already entered into a phase of dangerous climate change. Scientists have long called 2 degrees of warming the threshold of catastrophe, and I think it's unlikely, if not impossible, that we stay below that level. But we are not going to be dealing with climate change this century, I don't think, of 4 or 5 or even 6 degrees of warming, which a few years ago seemed the path that we were on. So we have about cut in half our expectations of warming this century in just 5 years, and that's really remarkable. But we've also lost the opportunity to secure a sub-dangerous normal seeming climate. And as a result, we're going to be living, all of us and all of our children and all of our grandchildren, in a climate muddle between those two poles, well past normal and yet mercifully short of apocalypse. Now, how you think about that future, whether you think of it in optimistic terms or pessimistic terms, probably says more about the sort of political preconceptions that you bring to that question than it does the science itself. The science says the changes will be dramatic. The obstacles to human flourishing will be enormous, but they are not so large that we need to stop imagining a human response and a human future. They are merely large enough that we need to reorient our political project, both at the local and national level and at the international level, towards the job of securing the promise of human flourishing and human justice on the other side of that warming, as opposed to living in fear that warming will be so significant that no hope of human flourishing can survive.
David Wallace Wells, a science journalist at the New York Times, thank you so much for the writing and thinking that you have done about this and your ability to, as you have just done, put together a long-range formulation of what we have to expect and how we might deal with it, depending on where we're coming from. Thanks so much for being on our program.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
The producer of To The Point is Andrea Brody, and our engineer is John Meek. I'm Warren Olney. Thanks so much for joining us. Tune in next time to The Point.